We are just weeks away from the general election here in Connecticut on November 7th, and we want to make sure you're ready to vote. So who better to speak with than our Secretary of State? Stephanie Thomas is back on the show with us. Hey, Stephanie, how are you?
I am well. So great to be back here, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm glad to have you here. Thanks for getting up early and chatting with us. It's so important that we get some voter turnout numbers that Connecticut can be proud of. And we really have elections where people are getting involved. So I want to make sure everyone has the details and that they are set to go before November 7th. Let's talk about being registered to vote. How do you make sure you are registered? And if you're not, what do you do?
Okay, great. Definitely, there's three things I want people to check or do before, like, do it today, right now. Check that you're registered. Many people think they are, but they're not. So you can do that at myvote.ct.gov /register, or just go to myvote.ct.gov, and you'll see the option to check your registration. But also check your polling location. It may have changed if you're not a regular voter. So the last time you voted, it may have been somewhere else. So make sure you do that. And the third thing that people don't think about until election day, make your plan now. Decide if you're able to go in person based on your work schedule, personal schedule, or if you need to vote by absentee. That way you're not rushed and trying to figure it all out at the last minute.
So I think those are some really good things. And how long do people have to make sure they're registered? I think the state makes it pretty flexible, like literally up until the day before. How long do people have to register to vote?
Exactly. You can register up until the day before the election. And here in Connecticut, for general elections, we have same-day registration. But please, please, please don't wait until election day. You can vote. You can register online. Again, go to myvote.ct.gov. You can also go to your local registrar if you want to register. I say don't wait because what happens on election day, people get confused. They go to their polling location thinking they can register, and you can register on election day, but not at your polling location. It's usually at your town hall. So you'd have to call in advance just to find out where the location is in your town, and then you can register that day if you need to.
So again, we have the Secretary of State here, Stephanie Thomas, to make sure you are ready for Election Day, which is coming up in just a few short weeks. Tell us, if you want to get an absentee ballot, Stephanie, what do people have to do to receive that? And also, what are the rules about then putting your absentee ballot into the drop box?
Sure. So stick with me, folks. The easiest thing you can do, absentee ballots are available now. So if you have the option to go to your town hall, visit your town clerk's office, you can go fill out your application, receive your ballot right then and there, vote it, and return it to the town clerk, like one-stop shopping. That is the easiest thing to do. If that's not possible, you have a few options. Absentee ballots in Connecticut are a two-step process. You have to apply. Once the town clerk receives your application, they verify that you're an eligible voter, and then they mail you a ballot, you vote it, and you return it. So you can apply online, same thing, myvote.ct.gov. You can also apply in person at your town clerk's office, even if you can't wait and vote at that moment. You can also get an application at your registrar's office. So once you receive your actual ballot, please, please, please be sure to follow all of the instructions. If you don't sign it, if you do something, I've heard people say, like, oh, I'm going to save a stamp and put two ballots in the same envelope. That is not allowed. So follow the instructions very closely to make sure your ballot will be counted, and then you can mail it in or you can drop it off in the drop box.
And who's allowed to drop it off if you have elderly people who cannot drive or are not able to leave their homes? Who is allowed to drop off your ballot?
So it's a bit complicated of an answer, which is why I'm so in favor of voter education. If you are mailing it or putting it in a drop box, the only people allowed to do that for you, in addition to yourself, has the immediate family member of a student, designee of a voter who has a physical disability or illness, and they have to be a designee, like a caregiver, or, you know, it could be a member of your family who's a caregiver. But the main thing is that person has to have consented to be your designee if it's a caregiver. Also, a police officer, a registrar, an assistant registrar, deputy registrar, etc. If you are returning it in person to the town clerk, it can be the immediate family member of a voter. And that's a really important distinction, because I think people just think like, hey, you know, my sibling is going to put it in the drop box, I'll give it to them. But that is not the case. They can do that in person with the town clerk, but not at a drop box or returning by mail.
I saw this week, Secretary of State Thomas, that the State Elections Enforcement Commission voted unanimously to investigate elderly housing complexes in several locations across the state, including Norwalk. Obviously, we have what's playing out as alleged absentee ballot fraud in Bridgeport. Tell us what your concerns might be with the absentee ballot drop boxes ahead of this general election, and what is the state doing to make sure that we're not abusing them?
Yeah, so drop boxes obviously do a lot of good. They're very helpful for many different types of people. And I think we don't have a widespread problem. I feel confident overall about our election security. Prior to when I took office, when the drop boxes were first put in, the secretary's office definitely followed the guidance of the Department of Homeland Security that oversees elections, CISA, and they recommended that drop boxes be placed in very public areas near town halls, police stations. In many towns, followed that guidance and have the drop boxes under surveillance, like we saw in Bridgeport. I think I definitely look forward to working with the legislature next year when they're in session, because I do think surveillance should be required. But more importantly, it should be required that people watch that footage. I think a lot of towns have the cameras, but no one's really monitoring it. And I think that would be a great way to increase the security.
We have the Secretary of State here, Stephanie Thomas, and we're getting ready for the general election coming up in just a few weeks on November 7th. I have an idea. So the Secretary of State and I have talked about this, actually. It's so frustrating that every year it seems like, unless it's a presidential election, voter turnout is just really low in Connecticut. And I don't know if I'm on the money with this, Stephanie, so please feel free to say, oh, that's really sweet that you came up with that idea, but you're totally missing the mark. It's fine. You would know. You're the professional, not me. But I live in Milford. I have spoken to so many people, including people who are in my own family who live in Milford, and they have no idea who's running for the mayor. They have no idea. Mm-hmm. No clue. They have no idea who's running for mayor. They have no idea why we even vote for a clerk. They don't. And what's amazing is not my family, but I have spoken to people in Milford who still think Ben Blake is running the city. Ben Blake has been gone for 5 months. I mean, I'm so serious, Stephanie. And you laugh, and I've laughed too, but it's so true that
I laugh to keep from crying.
Right. It's because it's so, but I do think that we, and I don't know if it's the state or if it's just the municipality, but I don't know if we do a good enough job of of letting people know, first of all, the weight of these jobs, the importance of them, and what they actually mean to these people every day. But also, I don't think we do a great job in letting people know about the candidates. And what I mean by that is we've got signs all over Milford. Some of them just say, "We love Carrie." I don't know who Carrie is. Apparently, Carrie's running for mayor. I mean, we've got another one that says Tony G. All you see is Tony G. Who's Tony G? Apparently, he's running for mayor. So what I'm getting at is I'm wondering if the state, because we're going all digital, it seems like the governor's very big into all digital. What do you think about creating a platform where, and municipalities would have to get on board with this, where you go on this website, it could be on the state's website, but you can look up your municipality and you're able to click on. So let's say you go on to Milford's, and when you see Milford there, it says mayoral race. You click on it. It shows the two candidates running, and you click and it goes right to their campaign website so that you know who the person is. You learn about their platforms. You at least can educate yourselves a little bit better, because I know voter turnout. I want to say part of it is because people have no idea what or who they're even voting for, so why bother showing up? Like, that's a mentality of I know people personally who are like, I don't think I'm going to show up. Like, what's the point? I have no idea who I'm even voting for. And it keeps from people just voting down the Democratic line and down the Republican line, like really educating voters incentivizing them to want to vote during the general election. What do you think about that?
Well, Melissa, I hope you come testify in Hartford one day. There's an easy answer for all of this. Funding into our elections. Most people don't realize the Secretary of the State's office has no budget allocated to public outreach and public education.
That's
outrageous. $0.
That's crazy.
So we basically rely on campaigns and parties to tell the public everything there is to know about voting, how to vote. We beg shows like yours to come on to talk about it. And that makes no sense to me. And I think that is part of the reason, like in presidential years, we see about 80% turnout. In local years, it's closer to 33%.
That's insane.
So these are people who are registered, believe in voting, but don't show up. But I think it's because they don't have information. Some people don't even know the election's coming. Some people, as you say, have no idea who's on the ballot, what's on the ballot, why it's important. If I had money, I'd be running ads. I'd be doing mailers, etc. But every issue that I talk to people about, things like property taxes, how much open space their town has, how Board of Education dollars are being spent,
yes,
zoning, housing, parking, these are all the things determined in these local years, and only 33%. In some towns, it's as low as 6% are showing up to vote.
That's
and
crazy.
I think Connecticut wants to do better and can do better. We have to get more money into our elections. And by the way, there is a law on the books that enables our office to put together a voter guide, but it's within available appropriations. And apparently there are no available appropriations, so we don't do it.
Yeah, that actually explains a lot, because to me, I really do feel, you know, and it's something that I know we try to do on our station. I know a lot of local stations try to do it, where they will let you know about the election night turnout and how numbers are going. But and even letting you know about some of the, you know, the people who are campaigning, we'll have them on the show and stuff. But if you didn't catch it that day, or you don't go back and listen to the podcast, I just think the general population really has no desire to vote, because they just feel like my vote doesn't matter, because I literally have no idea who I'm voting for. I don't know why it even matters. And I don't know if that's even something that municipalities have to come up with that kind of money to figure out, you know, maybe doing open houses. I have to say kudos to Milford a couple weeks ago for doing an open house at City Hall and saying, here's what a city clerk does. Here's what this office does. I don't know how many people showed up, but I just think the education aspect is not there. It's just not there.
In groups like the League of Women Voters, they do a great job. Many towns like mine, they do put together a voter guide. But budgets being what they are for everybody, they usually have it online these days, whereas, you know, a decade or so ago, they might have been able to do a mailer. So funding in the election space, whether it's at the municipal level, the state level, definitely very important. When I was running for office and outdoor knocking, the number one question I would get from people, like just everybody across all parties, was, is there one place I can go and get all the information I need
exactly.
about who's running and what that job is? And I had to tell them no, because there wasn't.
Let me know when you want me to testify. I just think that if we really want to care about our local politics, we want turnout to be there, people have to feel like they know what they're talking about. And honestly, I'm hearing from people just as a news reporter, they don't know. They just don't know. They don't even realize that someone like Ben Blake hasn't been in office for 5 months. I'm so serious about it, and it's so disheartening, but it's true. So, yeah, you let me know when you want me to testify, because I can't believe we don't invest in this. That's crazy.
I agree.
Well, Secretary of State Stephanie Thomas, I really appreciate you coming on ahead of the general election. Thank you so much. We'll continue to try to get the word out there before November 7th. And you're always welcome to come back on the show. Let me know if you want to come back on before the general election on November 7th.
Thanks, Melissa. Always a pleasure. Always happy to come back.
All right. Thank you again. Secretary of State Stephanie Thomas here on WICC.
Young men and boys have been socialized to believe that masculinity happens in very particular ways, and those ways have often resulted in a lot of interpersonal and interpsychic violence for young men. And in order to really begin to change those belief systems that would reduce violence of all forms, relationships have to be built, and mentoring is a perfect place for those relationships to build, to see that there are different ways of being as a man that don't always involve dominance and power and control.
So you're hearing just a snippet of what I thought was a very powerful, almost 6-minute film. It was showed during the Center for Family Justice vigil that happened earlier this month, marking the domestic violence victims who we have lost in just the last year in Connecticut. And this whole video talked about men not only being mentors to other men, but also being active participants in stopping unhealthy relationships and stopping people from treating others poorly in a relationship. And why are we talking about this? Well, because it's Purple Thursday, bringing awareness of domestic violence in our state. We know that a purple flag is flying today over the state capitol here in Connecticut. People are wearing purple, and it's bringing awareness to the problem. And I wanted to specifically talk about the man's role in stopping domestic violence as a whole. And so who better to talk to than Gary McNamara? You are familiar with Gary as one of our law enforcement experts on the show. He is currently the Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University. He's the former Chief of Police in Fairfield, but he also is in charge. He's the Executive Director, I should say, or he's in charge of the White Ribbon Campaign. And I believe that is connected directly to Sacred Heart University. So Gary, welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you here to talk about this specifically. How are you?
I'm good, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, of course. First of all, what is your exact title with the White Ribbon Campaign? I want to make sure I'm saying it correctly.
Yeah, I know. So I chair the White Ribbon Campaign for the Center for Family Justice.
Okay. So that's with the Center for Family Justice. But you've brought the White Ribbon Campaign to Sacred Heart University to the point that even fraternities have gotten involved with it. Why did you do that?
Well, we know that, you know, most men, you know, most of the offenders in these cases are men, but most men are not offenders. And so if most men are not offenders, we need men to get together and kind of talk to those people who might be offenders and take them on a path that will take them away from offending. And that's really the key. And so men play an important role in that. And who better than some fraternities up at Sacred Heart University, our athletic teams, and others to kind of understand the message and start living that message. And it was evident at the candlelight vigil where Delta Tau Delta, the entire group, showed up at that vigil.
Yeah, I noticed that, which was really, really special. And it was a beautiful, I thought, symbol of unity and wanting to see change with domestic violence. Tell us, Gary, what is happening in today's society, what the mentality is for men sometimes in a relationship, and why sometimes it can go south and domestic violence can become apparent in a relationship.
Well, you know, oftentimes men are raised to be in charge and be in control. And some of it is because, you know, that may be the role they believe they should play. But that can oftentimes turn to be very aggressive. And if they don't get their way, they feel that they're less than a man. And, you know, domestic violence and intimate partner violence is all about, or oftentimes about, control. And if men who don't have a clear understanding of what it means to be in a healthy relationship feel that they don't have control, then they take it out in an aggressive form or in a controlling fashion. And we see that in dating violence. We see that in marriages. And so that's kind of why we need to share with men and boys that there are other ways in which being a real man is the way to go.
So we have Gary McNamara here, and he is the chair of the White Ribbon Campaign through the Center for Family Justice. And what exactly is the White Ribbon Campaign for people who aren't familiar, Gary?
You know, it started in 1989 up in Canada as a result of an incident where several women were targeted and killed. And it really is, the purpose of the White Ribbon is to engage men, to bring awareness to the issues of intimate partner violence. I always have trouble saying that. And engage men in prevention. You know, we're taking it a little step further here at the Center for Family Justice. And we're saying, okay, you know, being a non-offender is not enough. You know, as I said before, most men don't offend. Okay, that's not really enough. Well, now we're starting to really say you have to engage. We need men to engage. That's why we're beginning to talk more about what it means to be a bystander, what you witness, how you can interject yourself or seek help for people who you think are being mistreated. So we're starting to take it a little bit farther than just awareness. Purple Tie Thursday, or Purple Thursday, is important. The reason we call it Purple Tie Thursday is oftentimes men are the ones who wear tie in their fashion. So if we can get men to wear ties, that symbolizes that we're having an effect, that men are now bringing the awareness of domestic violence to others.
And again, Gary McNamara is here. He's one of our law enforcement experts on the show because he's the former chief of police in Fairfield. He currently is the chief and executive director of public safety and government affairs at Sacred Heart University. He also, though, chairs the White Ribbon Campaign. And this, I believe, started back in the mid-2010s, right? Like 2015, maybe, somewhere around there?
Yeah, 2008. I think it was 2008 I became involved.
Okay.
At the Center for Family Justice. So it was brought to the Center for Family Justice, and I've been involved since 2008.
Do you feel like it's making a difference, Gary?
I do. I do. You know, it's little things. Oftentimes, well, look at all the things we do. Some of the events we talk about, you know, we'll talk about in April, the Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event, the Delta Tau Delta group. There's so many. There's a Coach Ty in Stratford that works on, who deals with the football players there and is having great impact and having positive discussions. There's all, you know, we're not nearly where we need to be, but, you know, having this discussion is important. Anytime we can get men to talk about domestic violence and ways in which we can prevent it and mentor kids to go in a different direction, we're having success, and it's making all of us better. It's a full game. It's not going to be one inning.
Today is Purple Thursday, and it brings awareness to domestic violence in our state and combating the problem. Gary McNamara is here, and he is the chair of the White Ribbon Campaign, which is done through the Center for Family Justice. And it's a call for men to step up and really take action. Gary, repeat what you said in the beginning of this, that statistic that you said that about men and being offenders, because I think it really resonates with the purpose of having something like the White Ribbon Campaign. What did you share before?
It does, and the fact is that most of the offenders of domestic violence are men. However, most men are not offenders.
Mm-hmm. I think that just speaks such volumes, and the fact that men need to step up and even at a young age point out, hey, man, that's not cool. It's not how you talk to somebody. And again, I don't want to say that it's just women who are victims in a domestic violence incident.
Right.
There are certainly men who are as well. But again, when you see the amount of women who are in these situations, it certainly outweighs the amount of men. But I also think that speaks truth to, you know, again, men speaking up about domestic violence and how unacceptable it is. And for them to also advocate and say that we should not be attacked by people either. How do you do it, though, Gary? How do schools take on something like this? How do they encourage their boys and their teenage boys to step up and take a stand, because kids start dating in their middle and high school years, and that's when these habits can start to form?
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, Melissa, I have two daughters and a son, and I think we all have to reflect on, you know, we talk about it a lot, like, you know, as parents, oh my gosh, could you imagine being the father of a woman who lost her life to domestic violence? We talk about it, but we really don't think, really personalize it. I don't want my daughters to be victims, and I don't want my son to victimize. Now they're older, so, you know, and hopefully I'll continue to have that same message. And now they're older and they're, you know, carrying on and being good role models. But when you have young kids, when they start going to school, they will integrate into friends and behaviors that occur. So all of us have to understand, especially at the schools, they have to understand to be aware of this behavior. You know, to your point, dating starting. What is the norm? Who am I hanging out with? So I think it's key that we send them. First of all, the center does a lot of work and a lot of good work with our schools, not only the universities all throughout the area, but also our high schools and elementary schools, to try to send that message. We work with the superintendents of every district in the six towns. But in addition to that, you know, we have to kind of, you know, continue to send those basic messages of what it means to be a good human.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you said, you know, the White Ribbon Campaign is about men, but we're not exclusive. Women can certainly join the fight, and we all are in this together. So be true to yourself. You know, what kind of human do you want to be? I mean, understand and always send that message that you never personally use threats or violence in a relationship. You know, be that good role model. Here's the problem, Melissa, is that sometimes kids who are in groups see something occurring, but they're intimidated, and I understand it. They don't want to step up. But, you know, that's important, at least get information to someone else to say, hey, I think so-and-so is in a relationship and he's being really in a bad way with someone that he's dating or someone she's dating.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of get those messages and encourage people to come forward. You know, bring that, you know, that's why mentorship is so important, and mentorship at the school level. I think those are some of the ways in which they can do that. But schools have to, you know, with all the other things that schools have to deal with,
yeah,
I think we always have to be aware that healthy relationships in our schools matter, and dating violence is a big problem throughout, you know, as kids start to middle school and high school, when they start to date, because we don't really think about it, and they're not going to come forward. I mean, it's hard enough for a married couple, someone to come forward with domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
Dating violence is a whole nother issue that kids are not going to come forward with it.
I also think, Gary, like you just said, to kind of piggyback, schools are already tasked with so much. I'm going to say it. I think it kind of comes down to the parents as well a little bit. And I say that because, and I know I do an awful lot wrong as a parent, as we all do. We all mess up our kids, right? We don't do it right. There's no, you know, manual on how to do it.
Right.
But I will say I was very proud a few weeks ago. My son was at a birthday party for one of his classmates, and there was a little boy who was, you know, picking on this one of the girls in his class. Maybe he's got a crush on her. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. But I witnessed my son go up to him. I won't say the boy's name. But he said, "You can't be doing that." And he's like, "Why? It's fine. It's funny." He said, "No, my dad would never do that to my mom." And what's interesting is my son is 5. And I remember having this conversation with him, you know, when he was maybe 3 or 4, when he started to get, you know, a little bit older, a little more, not aggressive, but, you know, little boys, toddler boys, they get to be like, you know, like football players, they think they are. And you know, one of those times he hit a little too hard. And my husband came in and he said, "Let me tell you something. You will never hit not only your mother, but you will never hit a woman, you know, like that. And he asked, you know, as any child would, why? Why can't I hit a girl? And my husband sat down with him and explained to him, this is not the way you do. And they had a whole conversation. I can't even tell you what it was about because it was a closed door boys conversation. But I was so proud to see my 5-year-old tell his classmate, you can't treat girls like that. My dad would never do that to my mom. And I think that you have to have those talks. It doesn't have to be anything serious. You don't have to talk about, like you always say, death or destruction. But you have to start normalizing that conversation, even when they're little, I think. I don't even think you wait till middle school to be like, that's not how you talk to someone or how you treat someone.
Yeah, and that's it. You're right. I mean, that's why these messages, these discussions, these community discussions you have are so important. Because it's true. So all the people out there who are in healthy relationships, they're in healthy relationships right now, and maybe listening, maybe not, but they're in healthy relationships, but they have kids. So oftentimes they think, well, domestic violence, interpersonal violence, I'm good, I have a great relationship. All right, but your kids might not.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I'm in a healthy relationship. I have good kids. I'm trying to help others, and that's really the key. So I think that's the key. The community has to come together and recognize that there are so many causes and so many things to do, and it's important. Purple Tie Tuesday or Purple Thursday, Purple Tie Thursday, it's important. But this is really important. Parents can make a big difference in being role models. That's why we're starting to talk about mentorship at the Center for Family Justice. That's why we continue to need people to be engaged. You know, you come to all these events, you walk a mile. People see that. Your kids start to see that. And they will mirror you. You are being a good role model for your kids, for your son. And that's what we need parents to do. And we need them to help be good role models for others who sometimes are in relationships or don't have good role models.
Yeah.
That's what we're asking for.
I think that's so true. And I you can learn more about the White Ribbon Campaign on the Center for Family Justice website, which is centerforfamilyjustice.org. Is that where they would sign up if they want to be mentors or learn more about it as well, Gary?
They will, yeah. Go to the Center for Family Justice website. You know, reach out to me. As you know, I'll always, anytime, willing to talk about it and move forward. And, you know, a lot of good things are happening at the center, and we're continuing to move forward. So reach out for the White Ribbon Campaign. The Walk a Mile is coming up in April. So many other events that we do. And it's a good opportunity for us to do that. So,
yeah, I think so, too. Gary, thank you for what you do, and thanks for talking about it here on the show. I appreciate it.
All right. Be well, Melissa.
You too. Gary McNamara, again, the chair of the White Ribbon Campaign through the Center for Family Justice. That website, centerforfamilyjustice.org.
Melissa in the Morning spends a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Senator Blumenthal, welcome back. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me back. Hope you and your listeners are well as well.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Obviously, all eyes on what's going on in the Middle East. It sounds like you are planning a trip over to Israel. Could you talk a little bit about your plans and what's the goal of you going over there?
The goal is, number one, to reaffirm our commitment. It's a bipartisan group to Israel. And to state unequivocally and clearly our solidarity with Israel as it mounts this counter action against Hamas to dismantle the terrorist organization and its leadership. And second, to share grief with Israelis and Palestinians about the loss of life and to support diplomatic efforts to contain the conflict, to stop it from spreading. We're planning to leave at some point in the very near future. I'm not allowed to say exactly when, but the point is that we will be bipartisan and very firmly united in this message of standing with Israel. And in the meantime, by the way, today the president's going to be announcing a major aid package. I've been helping to craft it, consisting of both military and humanitarian support.
Let's talk about the president's visit. He just met with the prime minister, and I know that there are a lot of conflicting reports right now, or I should say conflicting opinions on what's going on in Israel. You've got some people who are, of course, backing the Jewish population, but saying Israel needs to cease fire. However, you have others who are saying absolutely not. You know, we responded with 9/11 going and taking out whatever groups we needed to after the terrorist attack that happened in New York. And you know, somebody like Congressman Himes, who said, if you're going to tell Israel to cease fire, that's ludicrous. Where do you stand with what's going on and Israel's response to Hamas? But, you know, we do understand, obviously, that there's a humanitarian crisis as well. And it seems like the president is kind of riding that line of understanding where Israel is coming from in a counterattack, but still providing aid to Palestinians. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I strongly support Israel. It has to respond to this hideous, absolutely horrific attack, which consists of torture, burning innocent people, women and children, all of the atrocities, the abhorrent kinds of attacks on civilians that we've seen, characteristic of a terrorist organization. This war by Israel is not on the Palestinian people. It is on Hamas, a terrorist organization, which is a tiny fraction of the population in Gaza. So humanitarian aid has to be provided to the people of Gaza. But at the same time, Israel needs to defend itself. Basically, you know, we defended ourselves in 9/11. We went after the terrorists who committed these atrocities, 3,000 of our citizens killed. And we were largely successful in building our intelligence network, but also taking action against the terrorist organization itself, whether it was the Taliban or ISIS, so as to safeguard our security. That's what Israel has to do here.
So, Senator Blumenthal, I was listening, I think, actually, to my fellow colleague, Lisa Wexler, who's been following this very, very closely. And I have to say her coverage has been excellent on what's going on in the Middle East and in defending Israel. She was talking about articles she was reading on her show yesterday, and she specifically talked about how the attack on Israel and now Israel's response is actually a real win for Russia, because, as we know, there's still a war going on between Ukraine and Russia. And Russia, this is according to the article she was reading, that Russia is calling this attack a gift for them because it takes attention off of Ukraine in hopes that the United States will now be funding Israel and backing out of Ukraine. But also there were talks about other countries feeling like they we're just kind of throwing money when the next big war happens and they backing out of helping countries like Ukraine. What is your response? Are you worried at all about these two wars happening at the same time?
I am deeply worried about the efforts by Russia to exploit what's happening in the Middle East. The attack by Hamas, this horrendous, inhumane criminal attack, which, by the way, smacks of genocide because Hamas has as its goal the destruction of the Jewish people as well as the Jewish state, is a boon to Russia. It distracts the United States from Ukraine. It takes away some of our resources. But they are different types of arms that are necessary. For example, Israel needs interceptors for its Iron Dome, which Ukraine does not have and does not need. So the United States can do both, and the aid package that I have supported would do both. It would provide more support for both Ukraine and Israel, as well as for Taiwan and, by the way, border security. But here is the main point. Obviously, Russia and China and most directly Iran are trying to use this terrorist group, Hamas, to distract the United States as well as kill innocent people. And Iran stands to benefit because it's disrupting negotiations between Saudi Arabia and Israel that were aimed with great promise of possible success at normalizing their relationship. Iran doesn't want it. Iran wants disruption and conflict in the Middle East. Iran wants to threaten both Saudi Arabia and other countries around the region. And so we're against a combination of Iran, Russia, and China, which has played both sides of the street, as have some other nations. And it's a dangerous world. But this attack was not of our making. It was unprovoked. It was the result of Iran supporting and training and equipping Hamas, just like it does Hezbollah and its other proxies in the region.
Senator Blumenthal, I know you're very busy. Any chance you can stick around for a few more minutes? If not, I understand. But I wanted to talk about something totally separate having to do with Snapchat. Do you have a couple more minutes?
Well, unfortunately, this morning I actually have a classified briefing on the Israel situation.
That's way more important.
So
that's okay.
Yeah, we're going to have to. I'd be happy to come on at another time, whether next week or whenever.
Okay.
And because that Snapchat issue is very, very important, and I'm so glad you're focusing on it.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. And please, safe travels when you go to Israel. Certainly when you come back, let us know. And would love to have you back on. And certainly the Snapchat thing is not going to go away in a week or two. So we'll definitely talk about that. But thank you. I appreciate you coming on this morning.
Great. Thank you, Melissa. And have a good weekend. And be safe. And to all your listeners, thanks for tuning in.
Of course. Thank you so much. Senator Richard Blumenthal here on WICC.
It's time for another Melissa in the Morning Scam Alert.
So we are keeping a very close eye on what's happening in the Middle East, and there are people out there who want to help the victims and families impacted by the crisis between Israel and Gaza. So we have the Better Business Bureau here to give some wise giving advice to make sure that you are actually giving to credible charities and you aren't duped and losing money to fraudsters. We've got Kristen Johnson back with us from the Better Business Bureau serving Connecticut. Hey, Kristen, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I can't complain. Thank you so much. So talk to us, first of all, about, I would imagine we see this every time there's a crisis in our world. People want to give monetary donations, but that's the prime time, I would think, for posers to say, you know what, this is an ideal time to start taking people's money and they have no idea.
Right, because when, as you pointed out, when there is a disaster, well, whether it's a war or a natural disaster, people are so well-intentioned and they don't think about the fact that there are others in this world that aren't and that make their living off of taking advantage of us. And so we're really susceptible during times like this of unfortunately falling into the hands of a scammer. One of the most common scams we see is a message on Facebook from someone you know that you're friends with that says, hey, my uncle, my cousin, they're collecting funds for this charity. Would you mind donating? What I want you to do in that case is not respond directly, but pick up the phone and call or text that neighbor or that friend and say, hey, was that really you? Because oftentimes it's not. It's an imposter. It's someone that's taken over their Facebook page. GoFundMe is it's an accredited business. But you have to be careful. You know, when you go on these sites, you want to make sure that the people are being vetted. GoFundMe does vet the people that are raising money, but nothing is foolproof. Oftentimes, it's better to cut out the middleman, do your own research, just like you do when you're online shopping, and donate directly to the cause of your choice.
And another thing that I know the Better Business Bureau outlined with this scam alert is, can the charity get to the impacted area? Why is that an important note when people are thinking about a charity to give to?
It's really the most important. You want to donate to a charity that's established and has boots on the ground. Because when we're talking about a war zone, they know better than anyone what the need is, because they are there right now and they are established. So first, you want to donate money. You don't want to donate canned goods or clothing, because it's really hard to get that through. First of all, it costs money to ship that overseas. You want to donate money and you want to donate it to someone who's there, who's experienced with these sorts of relief missions. That way, the need can be met as quickly as possible.
And you talked about getting an alert, for example, on Facebook. How common is it that you get social media scams when these sort of disasters pop up?
I mean, we see it a handful of times. Every time there's a disaster, obviously a lot of people aren't reporting it, so it's probably more pervasive than we even realize. But that is one of the most common scams we see. That, and then just websites, not GoFundMe, but other websites that may not vet charities, where people say, "Oh, I'm donating for such and such. I have a family member that's over in this war zone, or was affected by this hurricane, and please help." Again, you want to look at where the money is going. You want to know how it's being spent, and you can do that by going to give.org. We actually have a growing list of charities that are accredited. BBB. We actually accredit charities just like we do businesses. And there's 20 standards that these charities have to meet to be listed on give.org. And we have 16 charities. And like I said, it's a growing list. These are charities that are not only accredited, but are actually focused on relief efforts in that region. Some of those efforts are taking place in Israel, some in Gaza, and some in both areas. So what you can do is go to give.org. You can select which charity you're most interested in. You can read about where the money is being spent, how they're using those funds, and then pick the one that speaks to you.
As we continue to watch what is unfolding in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas, we know a lot of people want to support the people of Israel, or they want to support the Palestinians who are essentially sitting ducks in this situation. Wherever you stand, people want to give to charities. But how do you know you're giving to the right charity versus you're giving to just an imposter who's taking your money? We were talking about monetary donations, but what about clothing and food, Kristen? What can you tell me about charities that are collecting actual items in person? And what should you be thinking about if you want to donate items?
Yeah, we certainly saw this with Ukraine, where well-intentioned individuals started collecting clothing and canned goods. But you have to remember that this is happening a world away. It's happening overseas. And so there's a cost to then sending all of those items over. It's best to donate money. That way, those on the ground can use your money the way it will be most helpful, whether that is buying clothes or buying food or medical supplies. They know better than we do, all the way here in the United States, what's needed most. So avoid sending clothing, avoid charities that are collecting clothing and food, and donate money instead.
So what about, because I remember it was right after what happened in Israel, there were a lot of local synagogues that were collecting monetary donations, but there were some that were doing drives for first aid. I remember even with Ukraine, same thing, that there were a couple places, I believe Save the Children was one, there might have been another one as well, that was collecting first aid equipment to go overseas. When they have chapters in other parts of the world, what about that? I mean, I would think that just takes research to see where exactly are your items going, but would you still go the monetary route versus giving physical objects?
Oh, always, because every charity that we speak to, they are always telling us money over items. They always say money over items because it's just not practical. There are so many logistics with getting those items into a war zone, not beyond the fact of what I just said about getting it overseas. But then once it's over there, getting it through that war zone, the logistics, the time it's going to take to deliver and disperse those items, it's just so challenging. They would prefer to have money.
And Kristen, what if you want to know exactly where your money is going? That's become a number one question for people who are being begged to give money, is where is it going? And what do you think about charities that claim 100%, like 100% of your money is going here? What do you think about that?
You really got to be cautious, because remember, charities have fundraising expenses. Even if you use that credit card to donate, there's a processing fee. They all have administrative expenses. So if it says 100%, you got to question that. You need to go to the website. If the website doesn't answer your questions and it doesn't say how the money's being spent, that's a red flag.
So, but are there charities that when they say 100%, could that be credible?
We stand by the fact that you should really be cautious. I'm not going to say, I don't know every single charity out there, but I think you should be cautious if they say 100%, and ask them, ask those questions then. How is that possible? Don't you have administrative expenses? How are you paying for the processing fee for my credit card? I think you need to ask for an explanation of how they're able to do this. And perhaps there's one or two out there that are, but a majority of them will, the ones that are reputable, they will have some sort of expenses. And you should be able to find all of that information out because they are nonprofits. You should be able to find that on their website. They should be transparent about that and what their costs are.
And as you mentioned, Kristen Johnson, there is on the Better Business Bureau website, there is a section where you specifically have accredited charities, because we talk about accredited businesses, but you do have vetted charities that the BBB gives a thumbs up to, correct? And if so, where
That's
do people
right.
go to see that?
Right. So if you go to give.org, and within each article that we have, such as the one that lists all of the accredited charities that are doing work in Israel and Gaza, you can actually click on a link. It opens up our 20 standards of charity accreditation. It's everything from board oversight to conflict of interest, fundraising expenses, program expenses, audit reports. It's really detailed. If you're not in the nonprofit world, it may seem very convoluted and complicated, but we try to actually spell it out for you. And so people know that they can trust, just like the businesses that are accredited, that they can trust giving to these charities. But then take it a step further. Once you see that, look at the charities and how they are spending the money for this cause, and decide for yourself which one speaks to you and which one do you think would have the most impact. Do your research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things we talk about all the time with the Better Business Bureau is to do your research. So again, if you want to check out where to go, I would start with give.org, it sounds like, mm-hmm. and you'll see the Better Business Bureau accredited relief organizations, and that's probably your best bet. And of course, you can read more on this article, which is listed at bbb.org. Kristen Johnson, I want to thank you, of course, for always giving us the heads up, and I know we'll talk again soon.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Kristen Johnson of the Better Business Bureau serving Connecticut right here on WACC.